Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Ben Pitcher about Back to the Stone Age, race and prehistory in contemporary culture. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Dave. Nice to be here.
This is an incredibly interesting book. And in some ways, I'm slightly puzzled as to how to frame the first question, because cultural studies and then something like archaeology is an academic discipline, and the idea of prehistory aren't usually things that we put together straight away. And I'm kind of fascinated by where the idea to connect these two, I guess, you know, academic areas, but also this almost kind of cultural phenomenon that you write about in the book, where that came from.
Yeah, for me, the question is around what we do in cultural studies, what cultural studies is. And in my understanding, cultural studies is a project to understand, if you like, the texture of life as it's lived in a particular historical moment, you know, how people conjuncturally in a particular time and place make sense of the world. So to me, cultural studies is it's omnivorous. It's interested in everything. And there's a sense in which I talk about this right at the start of the book. There is a kind of an intentional kind of amateurness to this, that I'm not interested in expert knowledge, but I'm interested in how dominant understandings of a particular topic get made, because that's how to understand social change. And I think, you know, personally, I'm astounded at the lack of curiosity about what is culturally dominant. I mean, it struck me that we should all be studying that, whether our focus is political or cultural or social, or whether we're interested in social justice or social change. So, I mean, you know, without wanting to be too shady, I think a lot of the Anthropocene debates in the humanities and social sciences end up doing things like applying theory to fine art practice. And I think that's absolutely fine. And I've read some really great stuff. But isn't it also interesting to try and understand why, for example, millions of people are reading that Sapiens book? And, you know, that's the you know, hence, if you like, the focus of this book. You know, it's exploring why prehistory has become really important in contemporary culture. I think every age has its own versions of the prehistoric. And so what I try and do in this book is to explain what's kind of characteristic of the contemporary prehistoric imagination, the way in which our ideas about prehistory can give us insights into the contemporary, into contemporary obsessions, contemporary anxieties, fantasies, desires. There are, incidentally, I was just thinking about your question, some elements of classic cultural studies that actually do prehistory. I mean, it's not a topic that hasn't been covered. So Raymond Williams' People of the Black Mountains, a kind of two-volume novel, is a 25,000-year meditation on the relationship between people and power. I would make the case that that's sort of prehistoric cultural studies. There's lots of good writing at the moment that sort of thinks with geological time. So Hugh Raffles' book, The Book of Unconformities, is really good here. And that was a book recommended to me by Vron Ware, whose latest book, Return of the Native, situates the English landscape in a time frame that links the contemporary to history to prehistory. And I think in a way, prehistory is quite zeitgeisty at the moment. I think for reasons maybe we'll go on and talk about. I mean, another reason for engaging with prehistory is biographical. You know, my thesis here is that prehistory has a particular resonance in contemporary culture, and partly that's self-reflexive. It's me being drawn to asking those questions. Intellectually, I'm interested in the relationship between biology and culture, and I don't think anyone has really answered that big question particularly well. So the book is an attempt to kind of think through some of that. Some of it is also more experiential. So I find myself, while I'm researching this book, taking up running, thinking about the relationship between that practice and our evolved bodies. I find myself going to standing stones, thinking about our relationship to the Neolithic. I find myself at a pottery class, throwing pots and thinking about the kind of physicality of craft that people have been engaging with for millennia. There's also, you know, it's also kind of touch with my own mortality. I think, you know, I'm 46. While I was writing this book, I went past the age at which my dad died, the age of 44. This sometimes gets a bit cliched, but there are some kind of big existential questions here about the finitude of individual human life, you know, thinking about those hundreds of thousands of years of human history, questions people have always been asking: what's it all about? Why are we here? How can we not be interested in this? I mean, I think everybody should be writing books about this. So there you go. There's an answer.
No, I think you've done a sort of fantastic job of giving a sense of both, you know, the really big ideas that the book engages with, but also that the book is quite fun, particularly actually the we might try and talk about what you are and what you're not allowed to do at Stonehenge, and you know, the kind of like tightly controlled space that is, that comes up towards the end of the book. To begin with, though, I want to pick up on something that you'd mentioned almost in passing there, which was this idea of kind of prehistory almost having a sort of certain dominance in contemporary culture, and I think you call it, you know, a kind of an important reference point in contemporary culture, and you'd mentioned actually that it's got a range of almost different kind of functions. And I'm interested to know a bit more about that, really, both in terms of what does prehistory like do in contemporary culture on the one hand, but also kind of why does it do that as well? I guess, are we so kind of interested in it?
Yeah, well, in my reading, the broader context here is one that we kind of live and breathe. Global heating, environmental catastrophe, we are on a kind of daily basis, whether it's through news stories or whether it's through our kind of reflection on our own circumstances, we are having to make sense of human life in a vastly expanded time frame. And so it, you know, this isn't a kind of esoteric area in the sense that geological time, evolutionary time become kind of necessary ways of thinking about who we are as a species, thinking about our species survival, if you like. You know, so there's a new story about cave bears or woolly mammoths kind of emerging, rotting from the Siberian permafrost. You get people like Greta Thunberg telling us that catastrophic climate change will most likely lead, she says, to the end of our civilization as we know it. The future, to many, looks really, really bleak. And so I think, and this is the thesis of the book, really, that we are turning to prehistory to think about how to live in a healthy way, to think about what makes us happy, to think about living sustainably. You know, Frederick Jameson famously said that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. And I think there's a sense in which prehistory is not the answer to that, but prehistory is like a version of the end of the world. It, you know, it is an idea about what happens when the collapse comes, or it might be a version of the human that offers some kind of resources for our own survival. There's a sense in which sometimes people return to prehistory to recover some sense of some kind of intrinsic human qualities. You know, so I think prehistory is of our contemporary moment. I think in the 20th century, capitalism could agree with communism with that kind of Latin American slogan, backwards never, forwards ever, that sense of the kind of onward teleological march of the future as being the kind of solution to all of our problems. And now I think that has slipped. I think there is a kind of lack of confidence in many areas towards those kind of those narratives of future perfection. I recently read, it's not in the book because I didn't read it before I wrote the book, but the last book that Bauman wrote before he died was called Retrotopia. And he talks in this book about the angel of history, you know, the famous Benjamin's version of Paul Klee's image there. And in Benjamin, the angel of history is looking at the past, but being pushed inexorably into the future. And what Bauman does is to kind of reverse that. And actually, his angel of history is looking kind of aghast at the future, at the catastrophe to come, and is being sort of inexorably pushed back towards the past to kind of try and make sense of their situation and to make sense of what to do next. So, you know, it's my argument that all those big existential questions about who we are, where we came from, and what we are like are becoming increasingly important. And that is why prehistory is so kind of resonant in our contemporary moment.
I suppose the shame of that possibility of something like an imagining of prehistory offering alternatives to contemporary capitalism gets expressed in things like paleo diets and sort of really grim sexist and racist views about society. And I suppose it's the sort of downside where you get these moments of sort of imagining of alternatives that how these things get, you know, sort of translated often in contemporary capitalist societies and media economies is into things that are quite, I suppose, you know, retrograde, regressive, and unreconstructed. And early on in the book, you try and grapple with not just things like the paleo diet, which is a really obvious manifestation of this, but you try and kind of link in various ideas about gender and race too. And I wonder actually if you could sort of tell me the story of the paleo diet as a route in to thinking about this broader idea about paleo conservatism.
Okay, all right. So there's quite a lot going on in there that maybe I try and untangle in a slightly different way. So let's talk about paleo diets, right? Let's do that in a minute. I think I first to do justice to your question, which I think is a good one. I want to just think first about how race and prehistory are kind of caught up together, because I think that's the kind of starting point that I begin with in the book, and it's one that we need to do to kind of understand what you rightly refer to as some of those kind of regressive iterations. So, I mean, I think my understanding is that race and prehistory are both ways of processing identity and difference, and race does this in the current historical moment. It does it synchronically, if you like. But it's my suggestion that we also have this diachronic understanding of human difference, that ideas about human evolution and development are to do with the passage of time, ideas about where we came from, those others, if you like, that are our ancestors rather than our others that are our human contemporaries. And so what I'm trying to do in this book is to think about the connection between these two. I don't think it's hard to see where this originates. It's been a very kind of longstanding perspective, actually, that, you know, the Greeks were doing this 2,500 years ago. Making a kind of correlation between geographical distance and cultural difference, the idea that the further away someone was, the more primitive they were, the more kind of backward they were, the more sort of strange or different they were. And this carries on into modernity. So the West begins to encounter its own pasts in non-Western and indigenous contexts. So there's a kind of temporal dimension to Stuart Hall's racial binary of the West and the rest. There's a sense in which time is absolutely of significance here. So, you know, in imperial modernity, these are obviously stories about white supremacy. They tell stories about white people as racially advantaged, and they are used to delegitimize indigenous cultures as backwards, as primitive, to legitimate imperialism and colonialism in terms of racial superiority. You know, if you can prove that you're the most advanced, then you are best placed to decide how land and resources can be used, even if indigenous people got there first, if you like. So there is this kind of pejorative racialization that goes on. But at the same time as this kind of negative association of indigenous and prehistoric difference, there are also, and fascinatingly, this kind of layering of positive connotations too. So that this kind of combination of prehistoric and indigenous difference becomes a kind of critical outside to modernity. It becomes a way of critiquing the destructive tendencies of the modern world. And so prehistory becomes simultaneously this kind of bad thing that we've moved on from, this thing that was primitive and underdeveloped, and also a sense of a kind of human essence to which we might return, we might go back to. We can kind of see this all the way through modernity. We see it in modern art. We see it in Freudian and Jungian psychoanalysis. We see it in our contemporary kind of working understanding of organic forms of human sociality, you know, the ideal size of a functioning community, for example. And so what we are intrinsically like comes to be defined through this kind of weird combination of prehistoric and racial otherness. And this continues for as long as we continue to make that kind of modernist separation of nature and culture, and we tie it to notions of development and progress. There's an Australian geographer called Kay Anderson that's written on this. There's a black feminist scholar, Sylvia Winter, who writes about race as intrinsic to the, if you like, to the definition of the human, to the definition of human nature. So if prehistory becomes this kind of site for defining our sense of who we are, where we came from, what we're like, and if our understanding of human nature is intrinsically racialized, as I suggest that it is, it becomes a really big and important project to try and redefine and redescribe the human in a way that doesn't reproduce the dynamics of racism. Because I think typically this is so often what happens. And I think, you know, to go with the example of that you mentioned of paleo diets, there is this sense in which that's exactly what's happening. So paleo diets, if you like, are a kind of time traveling, that people will consume raw food. They will consume what they imagine prehistoric people used to eat, incorrectly often. But that's not, you know, that's kind of subsidiary to the argument here. People consume paleo foods in a way to kind of escape some of the ills of the present. So, you know, forms of industrial food production depend on pesticides, fertilizer, forms of extraction from the global south. They create poor quality processed food for mass markets. And what paleo foods do is enable consumers to kind of distance themselves symbolically from the ills of the present by sort of inhabiting this kind of virtuous market niche. And this form of time traveling through prehistory is a kind of motif that comes up again and again in the book. The way, and I mean, in this example, the way in which the economically privileged can kind of slip outside of a polluting and unjust and unsustainable present and enter this symbolic domain of the prehistoric past, where they become healthier, they become better, they become a more natural class of human being. So there's it's a kind of interesting sort of privatized division of the social, where you kind of escape from the present through a kind of isolation or regression from it. As I say, these forms of kind of escape into the distant past give people ways of asserting their own distinction and that their own privilege.
I'm really struck by the story you told there, that, you know, we obviously the payoff of that sense of becoming better humans is also a story, as you've mentioned earlier, about the kind of sense of who we are as a, it sounds a bit strange, doesn't it, as a species. Mm. And one of the things, I mean, there's lots of ways actually the book engages with that question, and you describe sort of various contemporary behaviors. You engage with popular science, that the book you'd mentioned, Sapiens. But within what you were saying, I was really struck by the parts of the book that try and grapple with the way genetics and genetic science have really kind of come to the fore to kind of give us a sense of what human identity is and sort of who we are. And I wonder actually if you could connect that, I suppose, story of the things like the intertwining of nature and culture and then their separation, the question of the sort of racialization of forms of identity with this phenomenon whereby genetics will kind of tell us everything about who we are.
Genetics is really fascinating to me because genetics has this very specific status in our contemporary culture as providing an answer. I think that the kind of explanatory power of genetics is to do with our fetishization of data, is to do, and of course, you know, we're used to kind of running apps that monitor our you know, performance in terms of our, you know, we go for a run or we get an alert that we're overly stressed, or, you know, there's a sense in which the contemporary digital data analytics, it becomes a way of understanding, again, not correctly, but becomes a metaphor. So people will understand, dominant sort of understandings of genetics is that genetics provides, if you like, the data that runs the human machine. There's a sense in which if we can access our genetic data, we can find out the truth of who we are, in some kind of intimate and profound level. It's reproduced in, you know, people do genetic tests to sort of find out their propensities not only to certain kinds of diseases but also to aptitudes and affordances. So you know, there are genetic products that biomedicine produces to kind of convince us that that genetics is an ultimate answer to who we are. And of course, there are lots of critiques of this. There are critiques of the power of DNA. Donna Haraway's talked about a kind of gene fetishism, and there is a sense in which the kind of popular understanding of the of genetics enables us to forget the way in which human beings are kind of biosocial. And I think in my reading, there is a sense in which genetics tells stories that are essentially comforting stories, because they tell us that nothing can be lost. They tell us that as long as we can hold on to our genes, then we can hold on to what, going back to what you were saying a minute ago, Dave, what makes us intrinsically human. And that is a fallacy. That is a fallacy. I mean, human beings do not exist without culture. They do not exist without environments. And to reduce us to a code is a total fallacy, but that has an immense kind of hold on our culture, and I think there are really kind of interesting ways of sort of understanding that and coming to terms with that. Because of course, you know, in the 19th century, the early 20th century, science played a massive role in the legitimation of racism, and it was genetics that was given a particularly kind of redemptive role in proving that there was no scientific basis for race. So the kind of UNESCO statements that came out post the Holocaust, genetics were front and foremost in that. There were other people involved, like Levi-Strauss, anthropologist, but centrally genetics were part of that argument that it forms the kind of common sense of a sort of enlightened perspective on race today, that race is a social construct. And yet now with genetics technologies, there is an increasing kind of slippage between scientifically legitimate ideas, the language of population, for example, which is a language that genetic scientists use. There's a slippage between population and the disavowed illicit language of race. And this there was some controversy a few years ago with the population geneticist David Reich, who kind of threw some slightly kind of carefully worded statements, made the relationship between population, this legitimate scientific concept, and the idea of race quite fuzzy. You can always see patterns in the data. You can always extrapolate with, through the application of algorithms, you can find patterns in that data. And the question, which is of course always the kind of ethical question around race, is what do you do with that? What do you apply to that? And how does that, if you like, take on its own life? And I think that the sort of hubris of genetic scientists sometimes is that they feel as if the kind of robustness of their science is enough. But actually, once their science goes out into the world, it has legs. And I think, you know, going back to sort of what we need cultural studies for, we need cultural studies to sort of understand the cultural valences of ideas that were born in a scientific community, but then come on to have these important afterlives in contemporary popular culture.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
If that's a story about, I suppose, science, race, and contemporary popular culture, it can seem, I suppose, a bit sort of distant from the everyday lived experience of prehistory's role in contemporary society. And there's several examples in the book of this more sort of everyday aspect of that. And one of the things I'm really taken with that's towards the kind of second half, towards the latter parts of the book, was the sense of how we see the landscape. You mentioned Stonehenge already, but also how people kind of interact with the very idea of being English and what it means to, you know, have a sense of national identity through landscape. And I wonder, I suppose, two things about this. One, this is fairly kind of safe cultural studies territory. And so where did the idea to kind of bring in ideas about prehistory and then thinking about landscape, race, geography come from? But also, did you have fun at Stonehenge? Which is a slightly kind of flippant question, but hopefully it gives you a way in to talk about the importance of that place within this kind of idea of, because it's not actually British, is it? But, you know, almost English prehistory.
Yeah, and again, talking about slippages, the slippage between British and English there, I think is telling. To deal with your last question first, yeah, I did have lots of fun at Stonehenge. I've been twice, once to kind of more have fun, and another time to take pictures, and I'll go back again. And there is something, what, you know, whatever your kind of investments in prehistory, there is something quite beautiful and enjoyable about the kind of otherwise illicit and roped off nature of encountering a monument like Stonehenge. Of course, there are other, and people would argue, more interesting artifacts of prehistory within the landscape. But given that the as you've been alluding to the kind of special symbolic status of Stonehenge in nationalist imaginary or national imaginaries, there is a sense of being able to be amongst and to touch the stones, and you know, and to think about what people might have been doing there for 4,000 years or so. It is a kind of fun thing to do, absolutely. You know, I think in our Brexit moment, there are lots and lots of examples of where prehistoric monuments like Stonehenge have been harnessed to quite an exclusionary idea of the nation. You know, there are very conservative narratives there about national identity and belonging, and I think, you know, Stonehenge in particular becomes a kind of symbol of Britishness. You know, it gets conceived as a national treasure. There is a sense in which it is telling potentially quite exclusionary stories about who belongs to the landscape, who is in charge of the landscape. And in the book, I talk about some sort of images that tell these stories about prehistoric continuity, about racial continuity. You know, they tell kind of factually incorrect stories about white people's status as more British than people of color, and the relationship there between kind of landscape and belonging. And the argument, of course, here is that nationalism is a recent political invention. It is but a few hundred years old, and nationalism attempts to capture and annex something that is far more ancient. You know, it holds prehistory hostage, and there are vastly more ancient ways of thinking about identity and belonging. Now, of course, some of these are even worse, right? So the far right make claims on the prehistoric landscape. You know, that the BNP were doing it consistently for 20 or 30 years. There's a more recent group called Generation Identity, who talk about preserving what they call an ethno-cultural identity that they say goes back in Europe something like 30,000 years. These are factually incorrect claims, but they are very powerful claims that fascists make on territory. You know, there have been far right groups that have conducted rituals at sites like Avebury and Wayland Smithy. So I think it's important to kind of challenge these attempts to capture the nation. It's important to think about telling different stories about the landscape. And I think some of the more progressive voices will often leave those claims on the distant past unconnected. You know, our anti-racist imaginaries are focused on the future, on the future that we all want, where race has been abolished or the forms of racial distinction and inequality and disadvantage that exist now will not exist. But there's a sense in which when we focus on that future, we give over the distant past to the nationalists, the racists, the fascists, the people that make a kind of claim on blood and soil. And actually, the argument in this particular chapter is that we need to think about contesting those feelings of belonging and connection to the landscape. And it's the argument that our moment of ecological crisis does provide an opportunity to de-link the landscape from its kind of containment by nationalism, and to do that through feelings of belonging. The Nigel Clark, a very good culture geographer, has written about the kind of turbulence and the liveliness of earth processes, the way in which the landscape can be, we can enter into dialogue with the landscape in different kinds of ways. And what it always reminds me of is Doreen Massey's argument about the immigrant rocks that make up Skiddaw, the mountain in the Lake District. She says these were formed some 500 million years ago, about a third of the way south from the equator, and they now are part of this kind of English national landscape. And she gives us a way of thinking in geological time, thinking in deep time, and rethinking the apparent permanence of the landscape, and we can begin to challenge who belongs to the land when the rocks that make it up, if you like, have their own migrant histories. So it's providing some sort of different ways into thinking about the landscape, and particularly about sort of challenging those proprietorial ideas about the landscape somehow belonging intrinsically to white people, which is a fallacy.
The book concludes with this story of a hoax, the Piltdown Man hoax, but there's also in the middle of the book several discussions about things like the Cheddar Man, Neanderthals. There's also a fascinating engagement with the role of museums in constructing prehistory and how things like museums displays are implicated in both, I suppose, the kinds of reflection of interest in prehistory, but also some of the, as you've said, you know, it could always be worse, kind of problematic representations. And I wonder, to wrap up, whether you could give a sense of the book's engagement with these. I'm trying to think of how to describe them, and I don't think there is a common name for how you'd link a sort of anthropological specimen through to an out and out, hoax and almost the kind of cultural phenomena. But I'm fascinated by things like the Cheddar Man, the Piltdown Man, and I guess kind of why these figures are important, both to the times where they're discovered or created and now with us at the moment.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's a big ask, and I'm going to try and do it some justice. So Cheddar Man's a great example, right? So Cheddar Man was, going back to those kind of far right narratives about the nation and about who belongs to the nation. You know, Cheddar Man was claimed by the far right as an example of an Aboriginal Briton, right? This idea that he was an example of the people who first were there in Britain after the retreat of the glaciers at the end of the last ice age. And Cheddar Man, by the way, is the oldest complete skeleton ever found in Britain. So the bones are something like 10,000 years old. So there's a really kind of delicious irony with Cheddar Man, whereby there's some genetic research. Again, the importance of genetics to this this stuff is really, really fascinating. Some genetic research that was done a couple of years back that showed that Cheddar Man, just like the Western European hunter-gatherer population that he was part of, this was all kind of very well known to specialists in the field. Cheddar Man likely had what they defined as dark to black skin, and there is something quite beautiful about what the far right had claimed to be the first Brit ending up being a person of color. There is a great way in which we can start to kind of retell stories about the distant past to kind of found different futures, right? To kind of refuse the simplistic racist stories that we've been brought up with, and to engage prehistory differently. So Cheddar Man does that, not unproblematically, and I go on in my book about the way in which a kind of media telling of this just happens to leave people of color out of that story. So that the only person of color in this story about multicultural Britishness ends up being a 10,000-year-old pile of bones. There is some kind of really important issue there to do with who is it that gets to talk about the distant past, who is qualified to do that, and how you represent these processes on a TV show. Piltdown Man. I mean, Piltdown Man is another kind of fascinating example, Piltdown Man tends to be used to tell a certain kind of story about science and prehistory, and what I try and do is to use it to tell a slightly different story. So Piltdown Man was there was a skull, part of a jawbone, that were discovered in Piltdown in Sussex around 1911, 1912, around that time, about 100 years ago. This was perceived to be an incredibly important moment, because it became a moment when Britain talking about kind of national stories, Britain, England, slippage between the two, could be claimed as a site for the origination of humanity, because of course Piltdown Man was the kind of famed missing link. Piltdown Man was the kind of original or human or an example of an ancestor that we could all claim. And at the time, you know, a number of particularly European nation states were invested in being the first to being able to make this claim on having Aboriginal humans. Of course, the story and the story as it's developed, as we've come to understand the evolution of human beings, is that we are an African species. But at the time, this was about the kind of vying for prominency of European nation states. It fed into racist stories because the prominent kind of the experts of the day were fully schooled in ideas that the white Western people somehow represented kind of the apex of humanity, and people in other places were kind of at an evolutionary lesser stage. It was also, you can also read it in terms of telling kind of quite normative stories about gender too. But the point about Piltdown Man is that it was a hoax. It was made up. So the person that put the bones into the soil in Piltdown was a local man, quite low in status compared with the rest of the scientific community, and he was attempting to kind of bolster his own kind of status and credibility. A man called Charles Dawson, who perpetrated all kinds of weird hoaxes as well around other things. But what was interesting about this, and I think what is kind of diagnostically interesting about this for the story of the book, is that it sort of draws our attention to the question about, well, what is a hoax? You know, a hoax is a lie that is believed. A hoax is not objectively true, but in order to function as a hoax, it has to fit in with the cultural orthodoxies of its day. So a hoax can be diagnostic because it tells us that the definition of truth depends on it fitting in with these cultural orthodoxies. It helps to remind us that while current scientific knowledge always has the status of truth, yesterday's scientific knowledge is always understood to be flawed, shaped by the cultural orthodoxies, shaped by the prejudices of its day. And so Piltdown Man paints this kind of vivid picture of 20th century nationalism, of sexism, of racism, because it's telling in science and then in popular culture, paints that really vivid picture of the accepted truths of its day, which we have now since come to understand as untrue. It reveals how apparently objective truths are the product of a particular time and place. And so the kind of intentional fiction of the hoax reveals the unintentional fictions of the day. And partly my interest in this is because science will always exonerate itself on its own terms. You know, the scientific method is about claiming the understanding of what is true at a particular moment is contingent and subject to change. But science and the scientific community will often skip over facing up to the embeddedness of science in the prejudices of the day. And I think the example of Piltdown Man is a kind of way into understanding the way in which our understanding of prehistory is always shaped by contemporary culture. And so in order to understand what prehistory means, we need to kind of understand how it is working in contemporary culture. You know, we're not dealing with facts. We're dealing with the way in which facts always get caught up in values and are always being used to tell very kind of important stories. And in this book, you know, what more important stories could there be than stories about human identity, who we are, and what we are capable of.
Which I think is a fantastic summary of the kind of key themes and the sort of big idea of the book. And in that context, it seems almost a bit kind of mean to say to you, so what are you going to do next, given you've written a book that's grappling with, you know, such sort of big questions. But it struck me when reading this, it was the sort of book that you could launch, you know, a real sort of research agenda from, actually. And you know, even as we've discussed this, we've not touched on all, you know, kinds of different things that the book is engaging with, and different case studies and examples that are in the book. And so is there a sort of a next stage of this agenda for you, or is there a sense of kind of having almost kind of settled accounts with prehistory, and then might you move on to something completely different?
Well, good question. I mean, to me, writing is all about being bothered by things and wanting to know more about them. And there were some specific things I wanted to deal with here. Like I said at the start, thinking about the relationship between biology and culture, sort of getting to grips, I think, as somebody who's kind of trained in the humanities and social sciences, to kind of understanding better some of that hard science stuff. That was part of the project. And I think, you know, this connects to my broader project, which is about understanding race better as an organizing device in our culture. So my previous book, Consuming Race, was an attempt to show how race is caught up in ordinary practices of everyday life, and to make the case for a better understanding of this in order to better tackle racism, discrimination, and racialized inequality. And I think that's what this book's about too. It's needing to get to grips with, if you like, the racialization of the human, how race is central to the definition of human identity, human origins, and human characteristics. So there's a lot more there, right? there's a lot that's come up that I'd like to know a lot more about. So something we haven't talked about is the topic of race and air pollution. This is a topic I write about a little bit in the book that I think is really important, and I've been doing a lot of reading in relation to this. The dynamics of environmental racism, the resurgence of discussion of population change, that's a kind of politically important thing that I'd like to do. I've also, in the course of researching and writing this, met some really lovely people who work in archaeology, who work in genetics, and I found actually sort of moving out of my comfort zone in the sort of humanities social sciences, an incredibly it's been incredibly productive, and I'd love to do something collaborative with people working on prehistory. So I'm kind of open to seeing where this will go. There are an increasing number of people, I think, who are, if you like, professional prehistorians that kind of understand the cultural importance of what they do and the stakes of this in terms of the kind of politicization of the prehistoric. So we will see where that goes.